Chat with Traders, episode 52.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
What's going on, traders? I hope you're doing great and welcome to the podcast. This week, we're at episode 52 and I had the great pleasure of speaking with Dr. Ernest Chan. While many traders in the quantitative arena will already be familiar with Ernie, I'll give just a quick 30-second intro and then we'll get into the interview. So I guess you could say Ernie had somewhat of an unconventional introduction to trading. He started out on a research team at IBM, using machine learning and artificial intelligence techniques, teaching computers to understand human languages before joining a prop trading group. Today, Ernie has upwards of 15 years applying similar techniques to the domain of finance and trading, working with multiple prop firms and hedge funds across his career. And as of right now, Ernie is the managing member of QTS Capital Management. Just to top it off, Ernie has also written two books, Quantitative Trading and Algorithmic Trading, and he speaks at conferences regularly. Some of the topics we cover during this episode are diversification, capital allocation, generating strategy ideas, backtesting, and a whole lot more. And you can get a full recap on this episode at chatwithtraders.com/52. You can find everything there all in one place. All right, guys, let's do this. I'm your host, Aaron Fifield. This is the Chat with Traders podcast, and here is my guest from Toronto, Canada, Ernie Chan. Hey, Ernie, how's it going?
Oh, I'm fine. Thanks talking to me, Aaron.
No trouble whatsoever. It's nice to be speaking with you. Thanks a million for doing this. I'm really keen to dig in and get some of your insight on how you've had such great success in markets. I've been looking forward to this, so let's begin by talking about how it all began for you. Firstly, you graduated with a PhD in physics. Where did you go from there?
Well, I went to IBM Research to do something quite different from physics in the field of really machine learning and artificial intelligence. So I spent about 3 years as a researcher there before I moved on to finance.
Okay, and what were some of the tasks that you were working on there with your AI and machine learning at IBM?
Well, the group focused on teaching the computer to understand human language in all of its manifestation, such as machine translation, such as speech recognition, such as natural language understanding, meaning that understanding how to respond to human inquiry, like nowadays if you speak to iPhone Siri, they will do whatever you tell them to do. That's the part of the research we did, and also how to retrieve relevant information in response to a human language query, like what Google is doing today. So, but bear in mind that was in 1994. At that time, Google did not exist, and Apple does not have iPhone yet. So we were, in the quite early stages of this kind of applications. But the interesting thing is that the group take a purely statistical approach. We do not have too many. Any people actually that really understand linguistics or anything. Everything is based on massive statistical models applied to data.
Okay, yeah, and I mean, I can imagine a lot has changed since that time. So share with us, how did you actually get into trading?
Well, after IBM, I decided to move to live in New York City. IBM, though it's a great organization, has a research headquarter really in the middle of nowhere, and I prefer a more urban lifestyle, so I moved to Manhattan, and pretty much the only kind of jobs in Manhattan at that time that are suitable for a person with my background would be in finance. So I joined the data mining AI group at Morgan Stanley, and it's an internal consulting group that that consult for many different business units. However, one of the business that we consult for are the trading desk of Morgan Stanley, and at that, and so we have given some opportunity to develop trading models and you know, to see if they could be useful to some of our firm's traders. So that's really my first introduction to trading. It's really from a research, supplying machine learning algorithms for trading research, for trading strategies research.
Okay, so up until that point, you hadn't really had any interest or desire to really become a trader. It was more just those were the jobs that were available at the time. Is that right?
That's right. My interest was in machine learning and artificial intelligence. It's not necessary in whatever domain that it can be applied to. I'm more interested in the approach, the technique, rather than the subject matter. So whether the subject matter is human language or financial data, it doesn't make too much difference to me.
Okay, yeah, that's really interesting. That's actually something I was going to ask you about, so you've beat me to it. But is that still the case for you?
Well, I retain my interest in machine learning and artificial intelligence, but I am also, evidently after focusing on one domain, which is trading, for about how many years that would be? Maybe about more than 15, 17 years. Obviously, I'm now very interested in financial market per se. So, yes, my interest has narrowed considerably to one domain, which is finance. But I'm still, of course, interested in the techniques of machine learning and AI, though not on its application to other fields other than finance.
Sure, sure. Okay, so following your position at Morgan Stanley, I mean, what was the next step from there onwards?
Well, the group in Morgan Stanley sort of scattered a little bit after I joined, because the main sponsor of the group was hired away by Deutsche Bank to head up their global equities trading. He became a very senior executive. He was a very senior executive at Morgan Stanley. He was the head of the U.S. equity trading at Morgan. But at Deutsche Bank, he became the global head of equities trading. So, you know, it's a step up for him. But without this big sponsor behind our group, we a little bit at a loss for finding clients. So some of our colleagues decided to leave the firm and go on to Credit Suisse and started our own proprietary trading group. So that's I was asked to join them, and I agreed. So, you know, we went off to a prop trading group in Credit Suisse to apply this technique that we have been researching all along.
Okay, good one. Now, I usually ask this question, and I'm not sure if it's quite so relevant to your background, but I'm going to ask it anyway, and you can give me your thoughts. So let's say in the period of your first 5 years being involved with financial markets, what were some of the greatest difficulties you encountered that really challenged you?
Well, I mean, as with many of the algorithmic trading models, the greatest difficulty is that your model can look very good on a back test basis, but it is very hard to know if it is actually going to perform well in practice. And when I first applied these techniques to trading, obviously I don't have a lot of experience and intuition about financial markets. And so I approach it in a rather theoretical, or you can say mechanical manner. And it turns out that actually almost every model that I and actually we produce didn't work in live trading. You know, it worked perfectly on in a backtest basis, but it's completely you know, fail in the live trading. So that's certainly a big challenge for us.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So pretty much what you're saying is that even if you do have the you know, the knowledge of machine learning and AI and those types of things, applying them to financial markets, it still is very beneficial to have an understanding of how the market operates. It's not just as black and white as that's, you know, a different data set that you're now working with.
Yes, because at that time, at least, the data set that is for financial markets are very sparse compared to other sort of machine learning data sets. You know, typically we would feed millions of articles into a machine learning system for it to teach it to understand human language, for example, you know, literally millions. And whereas for, you know, financial data, especially if we are trading daily data, not high frequency trading, but, you know, daily data, there aren't enough data to really train the system properly. And so human intuition, I find, was necessary to really constrain the system so that it can result in sensible results, even with very limited data.
Right, okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. Now, Ernie, how would you describe your style of trading to anyone who is completely unfamiliar with your work? So share with us maybe the frequency that you're trading, what markets, and just a little bit of more insight to your quantitative approach.
Well, our focus is really in the intraday trading, but not high frequency trading. The reason for that particular time frame is that if it gives us a good enough Sharpe ratios, and you know, and a good Sharpe ratio indicates a good statistical significance, so that we know that whatever result we are seeing is not pure luck. So there are enough trades to convince us that we are doing something correctly, not just you know, random luck. But it is not high frequency trading, because to go into high frequency trading requires a much higher investment in the infrastructure that at our level of asset is not justified. So yeah, we focus on the intraday trading that holds for several hours at the, you know, on the average. We focus initially on Forex because that's the most liquid market. And then later on we added the futures models and then also stocks model. So and now we actually dabble in options as well. So we are you know, constantly looking for new models. So, and we do not restrict ourselves in terms of what markets we can research and trade on.
Okay, so trading such a wide range of markets, do you find that the strategies you develop for each market are vastly different, or is it sometimes the case that a strategy for stocks may also work effectively on futures?
The strategies are vastly different. You know, I know that there are futures traders, for example, who believe that you can trade orange juice future the same way as you trade the gold futures, and the same way that you can trade oil futures. You know, if they can find such a model, all the power to them, I say, but we couldn't. So we have a separate model for every future. And you might say, well, that sounds like overfitting to the particular future. Well, the results speak for itself. You know, the model that we focus on each market has a very decent Sharpe ratio and a decent return. So, and we have been running it for a while live, and it will not work on any other market. It just works on that single market. So for every, practically for every single instrument, we have a separate model for it.
Okay, and I mean, how do you deal with that when you come to markets such as just the equities and stocks markets, as well as options? I mean, or do you have... do your strategies operate on, you know, just a basket of stocks, or are they still individual strategies for individual stocks?
Yes, stocks are different because we typically run stocks in a market neutral strategy. So essentially a stock selection model. So we have one model to select what stock to buy and sell every day. And so indeed the same selection model is applicable to all the stocks.
Okay, sure. So running multiple strategies at any given time, in your opinion, what are the benefits of doing this? And could you give us an idea on how many maybe different strategies you're running?
We run over seven or eight strategies. Now, some of them have very little allocation. Some of them have a large allocation, so they're not equally capitalized. Some of them are in the experimental stage, so they have a trivial allocation. So the benefit, of course, is diversification. As a portfolio are subject to many risks. There are risks due to, for example, if you're long only portfolio, of course, it will be subject to market risk. If you are market neutral, but overweighted on, let's say, one sector of stocks and underweighted in the other sector of stock, so you will still have some factor risk. And there are some other risks that are not so apparent. So, for example, you have if you're running options, portfolio, you might be a negative vega, so you might be sensitive to volatility. So if volatility goes up, your portfolio will go down. Or you might be sensitive to interest rate. If interest rate goes up, your portfolio goes down. So every strategy has its sort of sensitivity to a particular risk: volatility, interest rate, market risk, factor risk, whatnot. And the goal of a well-balanced portfolio is that you want to neutralize any of this risk. So, and you can't do that with just one strategy. Each strategy is going to have a soft spot and it's going to be vulnerable to particular risk. But if you're running multiple strategies, hopefully their sensitivity neutralize each other. So a simple example is a long-short portfolio neutralize market risk. If you are, your long portfolio benefit from a increase in stock index, but the short portfolio will be hurt. But the sum of those two, the net of those two sides of the portfolio, will have practically have no risk. So that's what they call it market neutral. It will not be affected by the movement of the market index. And the same can be applied to any of these risk factors, whether it's volatility, interest rate, and so forth. And that's the goal of our portfolio, is to be neutral to any or most of this risk factor. Now, of course, we are not that smart. We cannot, we really haven't figured out exactly, under some weird circumstance, there's some risk that we have not neutralized. But some of the obvious risk we have eliminated because of diversification.
Okay, yeah, that's excellent. Now, let's imagine that an entry-level quant has created a trading system, they have a single strategy and are satisfied with the results from testing it. Is it wise for them to trade this without having other strategies to diversify?
Yes, I mean, you can't sit there and wait for 10 different strategies to all be ready to go before we start trading. So when we started our fund, we only traded one strategy, and obviously it was a very risky portfolio, and so we had a big drawdown. So that was unfortunate, but if we were to do it again, we would have lowered the leverage a lot, so until we get diversified. So yes, I mean, if you have just one strategy, you could also you should start trading it, but one should not over lever one single strategy.
Great. Yeah, I think that's really well said, Ernie. Now, I understand your strategies are designed to catch momentum, and then some are also designed to capitalize on mean reverting. Do you have to decide which strategy types are best for the current market conditions by turning them on and off, or is this something that's programmed into your algorithms?
No, we have not found a way to be able to predict, you know, in the next month whether a momentum strategy will work or a reverting strategy will work. It is very easy, of course, to do it in hindsight. We say, oh, geez, this last month we should have just run the momentum strategy. We should not have run the mean reverting strategy. But how do you tell next month whether you should do so? We have not found a model that can do that. Other people claim that they have this kind of regime shifting model, and again, all the power to them, but we couldn't. So what we do is that we run multiple models all at the same time, so that now some model will lose and some will gain, and hopefully the model that lose will lose less than the ones who gain, that gain. That's a very delicate balance, of course. We don't always do it right, you know. So we do have some down months. We are not able to completely eliminate the risk so that we have up months, you know, every month. That would be wonderful, but, you know, we didn't get to that perfection yet. But so far, it has been the case that indeed most months are positive, and the down months are down much less. Not much less, but less than the up months are up. So we did not suffer a big drawdown in a well-balanced fund portfolio. And so, you know, it seems that the approach at least worked to a decent extent.
Right. So with that being said, are there any discretionary elements to your trading style?
Well, there is some discretion element in terms of the allocation to the particular strategy. And the reason for that is that we constantly, some of our strategies are lucky enough to have worked from day one. And although they had been drawdown, never stopped working. So, you know, we've been trading it for more than 4 years, and, you know, they form the backbone of our fund. But there are other strategies that we started and it might work for a year, and then it become quite weak and start to lose money month after month. And so we need to reduce their leverage. Well, in that sense, it's somewhat systematically. We do reduce them based on their loss. But there are other strategies that we just created. It's a new strategy. Now, with a new strategy, you never know how much to allocate to it. I would say that it is imprudent to immediately allocate, you know, just based on back test. Oh, this strategy has a Sharpe ratio of 2. Let's allocate it based on the back test Sharpe ratio. I think that would be imprudent, because no matter how well your back test is, there is always the possibility of A, overfitting, data snooping bias, and B, regime change. So the live, and also thirdly, you don't know exactly what the market impact is until you actually trade it in substantial size. So therefore, when we start a new strategy, we are always starting it at a very low leverage and gradually increase it to the proper allocation. And that process is discretionary, because I don't see that there is a, there's no way to sort of systematically increase a new strategy, because whatever systematic way that you can count on is based on backtest, and the backtest already says that this is great. So, but the point is that we don't believe the backtest. Since we don't completely believe the backtest, there's necessary discretion involved in how fast you increase the leverage. So that part, I would say that capital allocation in the face of a dynamically changing strategy pool, some of them are dying, some of them are getting born, that process is has a discretionary element to it.
Okay, that's really great. Now, I'm really keen to ask you more about backtesting actually in a little bit, but right now I'd like to ask you a couple questions about some of the less obvious differences between discretionary and quantitative trading. So let me ask you this. How does profit distribution differ between discretionary and quantitative strategies? And the reason I ask that is because some discretionary traders will say, their profits are quite lumpy. So they'll say that 90% of their profits come from 10% of their trades. Do you find this is also the case with quant trading strategies, or is the equity curve somewhat smoother?
Well, I think that the difference is not between discretionary trading or algorithmic trading. The difference is between mean reverting and momentum strategies. Typically, the characteristic of a mean reverting strategy is that the profit of every trade is very similar. And almost every trade will be profitable, except there are a few trades, very rare trades, that will lose maybe 10 times the typical profit of a trade. That's the characteristic of a mean reverting strategy, whether you're running a mean reverting strategy by discretion or by algorithm, it would have the same characteristic. The opposite occurs for momentum strategy. Momentum strategy is such that a lot of trades will not be successful. In fact, they will lose a little bit of money. But once in a while, there will be a rare trade that will make 10 times or maybe more profit than the typical losses of a momentum trade. So, I would say that the sort of the profile of profits that you describe are really, I would say, differentiated by this, the whether it's mean reversion or momentum. Now, discretion or not, I think that the problem with discretion, now there's pros and cons to discretion versus algorithmic. The good thing about discretionary trading is that you can take into the context of, you know, macroeconomics. There are a lot of variables that you can take into context, like did a major earthquake just happen? Did a some major government decision just being made in some corner of the world? Your model could not possibly take into account all those rare events, but a human can. So, you know, a human can say, well, you know, today obviously there's a maybe a major default that is looming over Greece, and we don't want to trade euro bonds or something like that. Then that would be perfectly sensible, you know, a sensible discretionary decision. But your model would never be able to make that sort of decision. So that's the good thing about discretion trading, that, you know, you can take into the context and particularly rare events. But the problem with discretionary trading is that, you know, a human brain can focus on only very few things at a time. And, you know, research has shown that multitasking doesn't work. If you do multitasking, all you get is the degraded performance in every task that we do. So as a discretionary trader, you're unlikely to be able to manage more than a small handful of strategies. And as a result, the equity curve will not be terribly smooth. And that, you know, unless you're just running a very high frequency mean reverting strategy, but because of the lack of diversification for a discretionary trader, it is very likely that your Sharpe ratio will not be as high as a well-diversified algorithmic trading portfolio. And indeed, it will look kind of rugged, the equity curve. That might be why one might see a different shape of the equity curve, you know, being not as smooth as algorithmic trading. It's simply a consequence of the lack of diversification in the discretionary case. I challenge a discretionary trader to run, you know, 7 day trading strategies simultaneously. I don't know how they would be able to do that.
Yeah, that's very well said, Ernie. Thank you for, you know, explaining that. You mentioned in there that while you can't take all news and macro events into consideration, do you take some of these, you know, news events and sentiment into consideration when developing your strategies, or is it purely always just based off price?
Well, at this point, we in developing the strategy, we have not been able to take into account the news. But certainly nowadays, there are more and more vendors of news sentiment data. We may be able to incorporate that going forward. But even so, the back test does not incorporate new sentiment. There are some exceptional events that we would take into account when we are training the model live. So there are some rare occasions that we would indeed override a model in the sense that we would shut down the model because we don't believe that the model has incorporated those events that is coming up. And so from a risk management point of view, we will not trade because of those events, such as natural disaster or major economic event. So that's another place where discretion would come in, is that because our model does not have news data as input, we feel that it is prudent to sometimes override a model and not trade because of some exceptional news.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Now, let's talk a little bit about generating ideas. So, I mean, you probably get asked this quite regularly, but what's your process of finding ideas for viable trading strategies?
Well, I'm a sort of a vacuum cleaner of ideas out there in the public. And, I follow a number of Twitter accounts, and these are all accounts which regularly, on a daily basis, publish the headlines of new articles on finance and trading. So I would always make note of those that look interesting, and I will read them when I have time, and and I get ideas from some of them. I also, of course, keep look for books on trading, from fairly elementary books to books that stands with equations or full spectrum of them. I regularly consume them, and then also in the course of live trading, oftentimes you will observe phenomenon from your P&L. And that's one thing that really distinguish between a researcher that just sit in the office and research and look at papers and look at data, versus a trader who are actually watching the market in real time, because the information, sometimes your brain would capture information when real money is at stake that you would never be able to capture if it's just backtesting. So I often would get inspirations from some particularly unusual P&L pattern during the day that can be utilized for developing new trading models. It's from a variety of sources that these trading ideas come from.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I'm glad you highlighted that. How do you feel about academic research on market studies and that type of thing? I mean, I think you kind of mentioned it there, but I mean, one of the things I've kind of heard about academic research is one of the precautions that you should take is that it's not necessarily realistic to replicate those results had it been, taken in a live market. I mean, are there any precautions that traders should be aware of if reading academic research?
Yes. Obviously, one should not just assume that these research are going to be profitable. And there are many reasons they may not turn out to be profitable. Some of them are because they have been overfitted to past data. Others are because, they are have not taken into account transaction cost. And yet others are because the data they use are just not good enough. So, most research, after you read it and you try to replicate it, it might not work after you have fixed some of the deficiencies. However, at the same time, once in a while you will come across some ideas that work. And even after backtesting, and it still stand up to the scrutiny, and you trade it live, and it continues to work, and we have been trading one such a strategy, so that's proof that occasionally academic research does work. Now, one important point that I have made in my books is that even though a strategy that comes from the academic research might work, it usually does not work exactly as described in the paper. So, you know, no matter what, you know, source of ideas we generate our trading strategy from, it does not mean that we are just, slavishly copy what we have read. It always means that we have to make major modification. So anything we read in the public domain is to be treated as an inspiration only. It is not to be treated as a recipe. And I've made it very clear in my book also that I have described many strategies, and there are occasionally a reader would come back in email me and say, hey, this strategy, after a couple of years, doesn't work anymore. What's going on? I say, well, first of all, I'm trading that strategy live and it continues to work. Why is it that it worked for me but not for you? The reason is that I make modifications to the strategy that is slightly different from what I wrote in the book. So, and I encourage any reader to do the same. And I, in fact, urge them, make sure that they don't copy the strategies that anybody, not me, not anybody, not even a academic researcher's strategy in its entirety, because obviously very few people will be foolish enough to just disclose 100% of their trade secrets in domain, not even an academic researcher. I can tell you that I've corresponded with many academic researchers, and if they are not only just doing pure academic research, but they may have an interest in a hedge fund, or maybe they are trading for their own account, there are some details that they have withheld from the model, and so did I. So it is very critical not to just slavishly follow a strategy that as written on the net or on the book or in the paper, but always make sure that you have modified it to your own taste and scrutinize it in, using your own experience and your own criteria before you trade it.
Okay, so you mentioned in there that you have made modifications to your strategies over time. What's an example of making a modification? When do you decide it's a good time to make a modification? And, is there a difference between just making a modification and dropping that strategy because it no longer works? How do you know when to make a modification and when to stop trading the strategy?
Well, there are occasions where it is quite obvious what is causing the strategy to lose money. For example, you might be running a Bollinger Band strategy for mean reversion, and you might find that the strategy lose money when the volatility suddenly increase, so that what the previous width of the Bollinger Band is too narrow to be appropriate for the current high volatility regime. Well, one change you can make is to make your Bollinger Band perhaps a look back shorter, so that it's more responsive to the volatility. Or another way might be to impose a minimum volatility level for your Bollinger Band instead of just slavishly follow what's the past. You say, if the past has very low volatility, you would not follow it. You would still be, setting it at least at this width. That would be an example of how you would modify your strategy to deal with a particular problem. And of course, after you have this bright idea how to improve that strategy, add some feature or make some modification, we must also backtest this new modification, right? It's not just saying that, oh, I believe that this fix is going to do it. Well, of course, we have to go back and backtest it to see if that modification does improve things. Now, oftentimes what it happens is that it doesn't necessarily improve the return, but it might decrease the risk. And that might be an acceptable improvement. You know, just lowering the risk is oftentimes a great thing. You don't have to really improve the return.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, that's a really great point. And while we're on the subject of backtesting, I mean, let's just dive into it. So, what are some of the major pitfalls traders can experience when backtesting?
Well, one of the major pitfalls is data snooping bias, as we ourselves have experienced in the early days many times. The model is just simply too complicated, and so it just fits the historical data very well, but it has no predictive power. That's usually the main problem with backtesting. And the cure for that is typically to make sure that the model is simple enough and it actually sensible, not just produce good result, but you know sometimes you have to make sure that it's sensible. It is capturing certain market phenomenon that is perhaps well discussed elsewhere, so that it sort of increase the confidence that the model is picking up the signal, not the noise.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that kind of comes back to what we hit on a little bit earlier about how it's important to have an understanding of how the market operates, as well as the programming knowledge. So, let me ask you: to what extent can a backtest tell you the likelihood of a strategy producing similar results in the future? Like, how much do you rely on a backtest?
Well, we really regard a backtest as some sort of a rejection of a null hypothesis in statistical testing. In other words, we want the backtest to at least not produce negative results, because if it produces negative results, you know, we pretty much reject the strategy. We don't have to spend further time and money on it. But if the strategy produce a decent Sharpe ratio, and Sharpe ratio itself is pretty much a significance test. The higher the Sharpe ratio, the more statistical significance the strategy is. So if a strategy has a high positive Sharpe ratio, it really means that we are much more confident in that back test. Doesn't mean that it will also work in live testing, but a high Sharpe ratio back test enables us to find out if it is overfitted very quickly in live trading. Because if you have a strategy that, for example, has an astronomical Sharpe ratio, 10, let's say, practically, you know, every day, if not, you know, every week, if not every day, it would be profitable. If you have a Sharpe ratio 10, that's pretty much guaranteed that every week you will be profitable, and practically every day you will be profitable. So if you run the strategy live for just 1 month, you can immediately tell whether your backtest is valid or not. Because the backtest says that practically every day you're going to be profitable, and then you run it for a month and you find that it has a drawdown of 3 weeks. Well, that immediately tells you that your backtest is not completely realistic.
What's your guide for factoring in transaction costs to your backtest? So when I say transaction costs, we're obviously referring to like slippage, commissions, and market impact, that type of thing. How do you factor that into your backtest?
Well, one main source of the transaction cost is the bid-ask spread, and to realistically model that, one need to use high-frequency quote data to backtest, and that's explained in one of my blog article also. Why sometimes low-frequency strategy backtesting requires high-frequency data, because you need the bid-ask spread in order to bid and ask quotes to figure out exactly what price you're going to execute at. Just having trade prices doesn't help that kind of transaction cost model. Beyond that, we have to look at the top of book quote size. A lot of the strategy, particularly high frequency strategy, that look very good on paper and particularly favored by academic researcher, you will find that it doesn't work beyond the top of book, and that because, you know, it assumes that if you are trading just 100 shares, this model indeed is very profitable. But once you intend to execute 1,000 shares or 10,000 shares, this strategy will be completely gone. It will completely fall apart because when you have to take more than the top of book quotes and lose more money to take the deeper into the book, the back end will show that it won't work. So that's not only do you need the quote price, but you also need to know the quote size in some of these back tests. And then not to mention, there are even more problematic issues such as market impact. Once you take the top of book liquidity, how fast the liquidity replenishes itself, or if you put out a limit order there that is a substantial size, is it going to affect the order book? These issues are really in the domain of high frequency trading. Even though you may not be a high frequency trader, but if let's say you're a discretionary trader and you intend to hold for at least a couple of hours this position, but if you put a order into the order book that is much larger than the typical order size, quote size, you are going to affect the order book, and you are going to have incur an opportunity cost. You're going to affect things, and that kind of modeling nowadays being conducted a lot of times by high frequency trading research, and there are a lot of very complicated mathematical models coming out to model that kind of process. But but that's what I'm saying. This is the kind of transaction cost that's much more difficult to deal with, opportunity cost and the effect of on the order book because of your limit order. But that's, I don't claim that we have a grasp on it, but I understand that that this is a field of active academic research.
Okay, sure. So let's just do a couple more questions, and then we'll probably start to wind things down. What are some of the common misconceptions people may have around quantitative trading?
Misconceptions.
Okay. So here's an example. Let me ask you this: is quantitative trading just for an elite few who are math wizards, or do you honestly believe it's an angle that can be implemented by anyone willing to put in the work?
I do believe that it is suitable for practically anybody who is willing to at least learn how to use an Excel spreadsheet. I have collaborated with some very successful traders before that indeed have no programming skills except programming a Excel spreadsheet. Not naturally, they are not doing high frequency trading. They are doing trading that enter a position every once a day, but that doesn't mean it's not quantitative. Quantitative trading could be a very slow trading. Could be holding a position for one quarter or 1 year, if that could still be quantitative trading. So one does not need to be a math whiz, and certainly does not need to be a programming computer whiz in order to do quantitative trading. All one needs to do is to be able to gather data and backtest it, no matter what tool you use to backtest. It could be as simple as Excel spreadsheet.
Okay, so a trader who wants to get started in quantitative trading or really wants to dive deeper into the subject and, give it a real shot, where should they start?
I would suggest that they should start from trying to backtest some of the simplest strategies that they know about or they read about in any sort of trading magazine or blog or books. And there are many of them. I've seen some that are really simple. I've read a lot of trading books where the strategies are extremely simple, such as sell on the 1st of May and buy the index, at the end of October. That how can it be simpler than that? But that's a start. And or some strategies such as saying that we should always buy when the price drops below the 10-day moving average and sell when it's above the 10-day moving average, something like that. That can be quite readily backtested in an Excel spreadsheet. And once you gain confidence in your backtest method, you might want to learn a simple programming language. You know, I even though I said that yes, it's possible to start as a quantitative trader by using Excel only, but that doesn't mean that's the optimal state of affairs. To improve your ability as a quantitative trader to sort of expand the repertoire of your strategies, one should learn a better programming language than Excel, namely. And I always recommend one of three languages, Python, R, and MATLAB. So that's the next step. Once you have some confidence in backtesting using Excel, well, start to learn the programming language to so that you can backtest a wider variety of strategies, especially intraday strategies.
Okay, yeah, that's a really great answer, Ernie. And just on the languages there, so you mentioned MATLAB, Python, or R. How do you feel about languages such as TradeStation's Easy Language? What's the pros and cons of going in the direction of more of an open source language, even though I know you have to do pay for MATLAB to use that, but Python and R are, you know, both open source languages. How do you feel about comparing those to more of a, I don't know, you could probably call it a proprietary language like TradeStation's Easy Language? What are the pros and cons there?
Well, the pro of using a language that a brokerage trading platform provide is that it can be very easily turned into a live trading system. So you can backtest and trade live using exactly the same code and just flip a switch and it will generate real-time orders. So that's very convenient. The problem is that if you want to switch brokerage, all the script that you've written before, of course, doesn't work anymore. If you want to switch to interactive brokers, your easy language will have no use and you have to start from scratch. And another problem with those brokerage languages is that they tend to be rather limiting. They are not designed to encompass. Extreme example. Let's say you want to build a neural network to generate trading signals. I challenge you to do that with easy language. It's just not possible. I don't believe it's possible because if you want to build a neural network from scratch, it will probably take months. And maybe even months won't do it because there'll be many bugs, you know, unless you're an expert in building machine learning languages. For a MATLAB trader or a Python trader or a R trader, we would not be building a neural network from scratch. We would be using a neural network library that is ready-made in order to generate training signals. So that shows you the flexibility that is inherent in one of these standard languages. Whereas, you know, if you want to use the same neural network program in easy language, well, you have to wait until TradeStation develop it for easy language, which might be never.
All right, Ernie, well, thanks for summing that up. Now, you've got two published books. One is Quantitative Trading, and the second is called Algorithmic Trading. What can readers expect to learn from reading your two books here?
Well, I think the first book particularly answers some of the questions you raised earlier about how to get started in quantitative trading. You know, let's say you are a discretionary trader, or maybe you never traded before even. You know, maybe someone is a new graduate or came from a different business. Let's say they are an accountant and wanted to get into trading as a hobby or as a full-time job. Well, that the first book is really geared for that type of people. It really starts from the basics. The second book is more focused and perhaps go into some of the trading strategy in more depth. And some of the techniques are also more complicated, things like Kármán filter, the vector auto regression, vector error correction models, this sort of stuff, or you know, maybe a bit off-putting to a complete novice in trading, but they would be useful to someone who has traded in a in a systematic manner for a while, but would like to learn newer techniques. So that's what the second book is about. It's really introducing something a bit more detailed and more focused and more complicated to the traders who already have been doing some quantitative trading already.
Okay, yeah, and I mean, both those books are definitely on my list to read, and I hope to get stuck into those very soon. So I'll link to those in the show notes at chatwithtraders.com. Ernie, where can listeners go to find out more about you, and where can they connect with you?
Well, I run a blog, epchen.blogspot.com, and it's open to comments. Anybody can comment on it, and I try to answer them very rapidly to any questions. I have been used to updating the blog with new articles more frequently than now, but now I'm writing a new book, so I don't have much time to update it. But despite not having a new article published every month, it doesn't mean that I don't answer the comments that readers might want to pose on the blog. So that's certainly a great venue. The other one is that on my website, epchen.com, I listed my email, and a lot of readers are communicate with me just by emailing me. So that's sometimes when a reader asks me questions that are generic, I would direct them to the blog, because I like to answer a question so that many people can benefit at the same time. But other times, if they just want to ask for advice on a particular situation that they have, certainly feel free to email me directly. And and then also, of course, I run courses online and off, and some of the people who have read my blog and books would come to these seminars, and we could have a real-time conversation as well.
Excellent. Yeah, well, I'll link to both your blog and your website in the show notes also. I definitely encourage listeners to head on over and check out those links. Really great resources there. And Ernie, you're also on Twitter, I believe.
Oh, yes.
What's your handle?
That's right. In my blog, I oftentimes include my Twitter feed, and I don't tweet very often. I don't want to burden our followers with too many irrelevant information, but I do tweet once in a while when I see some interesting information out there. Feel free to follow.
Okay, and what's your Twitter handle?
Chan EP, ChanEP.
Okay, good one. And you mentioned you've got a new book coming out. When can we expect that?
Well, that should be out. It usually takes a year to write a book, and I just started very recently. So, it will go through editing and reviewing, and then production and the marketing. So we probably should see it in the first quarter of 2017.
Very cool. And what's it about? Is it a carry-on from your last two?
Yes, the topics will be largely different from before. Following the second book, it will go into techniques that I have not discussed before. For example, machine learning techniques. Options techniques, trading options, which I have not touched on before, and so forth. So it will be a bit more advanced techniques than what I've discussed before. And also, however, I will just sort of look back into some of the strategies that I have discussed in the first two books and see how they did, post-mortem in some sense for some of the strategies who died, what caused death. And hopefully we'll find some that didn't die either.
Yeah, that sounds really good, and I'm sure many people are eager to get their hands on that. So, Ernie, thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking the time. It was a lot of fun speaking with you, and I sure learned a lot I'm sure the listeners did too. So, yeah, big thanks for doing this, and let's speak again soon.
Great. I enjoy talking to you too. So have a good night.
All right, awesome. Thank you, Ernie.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.